The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll get to a couple of emails in today's show. Europe's summer of hate continues. In a moment, we'll be looking at the timeline of terror over the past couple of weeks that has all of Europe on edge. ISIS now is warning that London will be next. Churches here in Britain are on high alert. And so we'll be looking at, as I say, this recent spate of attacks in Europe. On today's show, we'll also be playing a few sound bites from the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia that's been going on this week. And if you can believe it, following on what we discussed earlier, I guess that was Monday's show, one commentator even compared a speaker at the Democratic Convention to Ronald Reagan. And so guess what? I've got more Ronald Reagan sound bites for you to hear. You're going to want to stay tuned for that. I think you'll enjoy them. So that'll be coming up later in the show. I want to start here first with an email that came in just yesterday in response to the program from yesterday. He says here, this listener from Arkansas, wow, what an exciting and amazing episode. It's crystal clear we're living in the time that Mr. Armstrong spoke about for so long. I grew up learning about these events and dreaming about them. Now I'm living in them. I've been in the church since I was 3 years old, and my mother started attending, or rather when my mother started attending, the Worldwide Church of God. This episode makes it clear Christ is about to return. Isn't that amazingly exciting? I just want to go out and shout it. It's just getting that close. And of course, that is the good news. Amid all of these tragic events that we're seeing play out now daily, Europe's summer of hate. That's what one newspaper is calling it. Just look at the past couple of weeks here. July 14th, a terrorist driving a massive truck just mows down scores of people in Nice, there in southern France. That was 2 weeks ago. July 18th, an axe-wielding terrorist. He injures five on a train in Germany. And then you had the shooting rampage in Munich just last Friday night, July 22. It left nine dead. Most of them were teens. And then the suicide bomber Sunday night in Ansbach, killed himself, injured 15 others. That same day in southern Germany, also in southern Germany, a terrorist hacked to death a pregnant woman. He killed her with a machete. And then, of course, yesterday, news breaking of this beheading in Normandy, just before we went on the air, this 84-year-old priest executed in France. Another carefully orchestrated attack that ISIS is claiming responsibility for, that ISIS is rejoicing over, and not ISIS alone, but others as well in the radical Islamist community. Let me start here from the Telegraph, this article that uses that phrase, summer of hate. It says that France is now under attack. Every day now, a new terror attack. A new barbarous way to kill innocent people, men and women, watching fireworks with their children, priests celebrating mass, commuters on a suburban train. A whole arsenal is deployed. Suicide belt and machete, pistol and Kalashnikov, knife, a 19-ton truck. This is the arsenal that they're using. Anything imaginable to kill as many people as possible. It says here, this is a summer that will live long in the memory. the summer of hate. At least this is the perception. It's a breakthrough moment. A fortnight of unconnected individual attacks have bled literally into one single campaign. A fortnight, 2 weeks of unconnected individual attacks. They've bled literally into one single campaign. The terrorists still look to commit the mass casualty spectacular, but small symbolic attacks are now just as important. They create the sense that something relentless is underway. France is a nation under attack. In fact, it's worse than that. This is a holy war that's been raging for years. It's just only now getting the attention from Western news outlets. The Catholic Herald had a piece yesterday stating that this is what life is like for Christians in the Middle East all the time. What we saw happen yesterday at Normandy, it happens all the time. Well, maybe it's tapering off in the Middle East because, well, the Christians are dying out. It says here, this is the Catholic Herald, an 84-year-old priest has had his throat cut by the Islamic fanatic while saying Mass in the church in Normandy. For people in the West, this is a scene of almost unimaginable horror. Catholics in particular will be revolted and profoundly disturbed by a bloody killing perpetrated during the act of holy sacrifice around which our faith is built. Catholics in the West, that is, Catholics in the West, for Catholics and other Christians in the Middle East, the atrocity at Normandy is far from unimaginable. They've been living with this sort of terror for years, while Western politicians and liberal commentators look away. This author says here, if I were to mention the Baghdad church massacre of October 2010, how many of them would know what I was talking about? Come to that, how many Catholics are familiar with the details? And he goes on to explain it. This is in 2010. On that Sunday evening, Mass in the Syrian Catholic Church of Our Lady of Salvation was cut short by Islamist gunmen who took the congregation hostage, screaming, "All of you are infidels. We will go to paradise if we kill you, and you will go to hell." One priest was shot dead at the altar. In total, 58 innocent people were murdered. Their killers were members of the Iraqi faction of Al-Qaeda that had declared war on churches. Dirty dens of idolatry, they called them. And in particular, the hallucinating tyrant of the Vatican. It's a holy war. It says here the Baghdad massacre was one of countless atrocities that have reduced ancient Christian communities in the Middle East to shriveled and terrified ghettos or underground churches. They're having to go underground in the Middle East. In these ISIS strongholds, anyway. Or else they're beheaded or shot down. They know, it says, even if Western public opinion does not, that Christianity in itself is among the most hated of all the targets of Islamic terrorist groups. For jihadis, the Christian belief in the divinity of Jesus is an affront that justifies the brutality of the Dark Ages. And it says finally here, the slitting of a priest's throat in the sanctuary of a church. How hollow that word sanctuary now sounds in the context, brings those Dark Ages to rural France. Well, and that's what we've been preparing you for. It comes right out of Daniel 11. Another Crusades-like clash. Another round of the Crusades. A religious clash. A clash of civilizations. A cultural clash. The Holy War's been, it's been underway for quite some time. But now it's finally making its way into Europe, and it's happening with such great frequency that commentators have to sit up and take note. France is under attack. It's not France alone. It's Western civilization. It's Europe. It's the Vatican, as this author correctly brings out. And it's leading right to Daniel 11 and verse 40. It's amazing, some of these news stories that I have for you here today, just what they're saying. They don't know what they're saying, really. But when you put it together with what the Bible prophesies, it is, as that emailer brought out, it's happening so fast. All these episodes make it clear that Christ is about to return to this earth. Well, coming back to this Telegraph piece, talking about the breakthrough moment, it says here this means a dangerous threshold is being crossed. And in this new world, political appeal is likely to be based less on the breadth of manifesto ideas and more on a leader's ability to promise convincingly to keep people safe. That's what it's going to boil down to now for leaders in the West, and you're seeing it already. In the United States, even. Anytime one of these attacks happen, you're going to see a spike in support for Donald Trump. Someone that's just out there saying, I'm going to keep you safe. I'm going to build a wall. I'm going to keep these kinds of people out. And that's because the anger is palpable. The anger among the civilians. The people just carrying on with their day-to-day routine in Normandy. And then all of a sudden there's this. Right in a small French town. Just look at the reception, this article says, given to his prime minister. This is speaking of François Hollande, the president of France, and his prime minister, the one, by the way, who said the other week that, well, France is just going to have to live with this sort of thing. He wasn't received very well because of that statement. Hollande is now so unpopular, he may not even stand for re-election next year. He'd be humiliated if he did. See, the attitude, the mood is changing in Europe. Not in France only, but in Germany too, as I brought out yesterday. It says the sense of national unity that grew up and survived the Charlie Hebdo and Bataclan outrages is fraying. See, those outrages, it brought France together, more closely united. But now people are upset. Now people are booing their politicians. That was happening on the other side. In the Democratic Convention on Monday, every time Hillary Clinton's name was mentioned, practically, she was booed down. Now, some of that discontent evidently was either moved out of the hall or just quieted down, I suppose, yesterday. But boy, you look at how divisive it was Monday. Look at the reception these world leaders are getting. It says, of course, it has always been the first duty of governments to protect their citizens. The crucial difference is that once doing so was principally about fighting other states. See, if it comes down to protecting our citizens, it's straightforward. We go and we fight another state that poses a grave danger to our nation. It says here in the 20th century, terrorism too seemed to be a conflict with outsiders, but that's no longer so. The old cliches, the enemy within, the clash of civilizations are being deployed in earnest. Political capital is to be made. Don't expect extremists on the fringes of both right and left not to try. See, it's different now. For so many Western nations, the enemy is within. It's already inside of our borders. How do you defend against that? How do you fight against that? Well, as one of these articles goes on and points out, the only way to counter it is by going on the offensive. And that's what the King of the North is going to do. Great changes are coming in Europe. This piece here, also from the Telegraph, says that these terrorist attacks could drive Europe into the arms of a far-right leader. It says here, as the seemingly relentless wave of terror attacks Europe has suffered in recent weeks demonstrates, ISIS extremists now appear capable of striking at will at any point on the continent that they choose. They can strike at will anywhere. Anywhere they choose. Because, well, look at their arsenal. They've got knives, they've got machetes, they've got lorries, they've got machine guns, they've got pistols. And they've got a network. They've got a network of support. They're all carefully orchestrated. Now, some of them may be a little more random, you know, people that want to get in on the action. But like with the attack in Nice, well, you talk about a carefully orchestrated attack, and the same with yesterday. It says here the political reverberations from this new wave of atrocities, which began with the Bastille Day attacks in Nice that claimed 84 lives, are certainly starting to be felt throughout Europe. And with elections due in Germany and France next year, they could have worrying implications for the continent's future. I mean, we've already talked about elections from March and the popularity of the AfD party, which won almost 25% of the vote in Saxony-Anhalt in March. I mean, that's crazy to think about the mood and the attitude that's already changing, and dramatically so. It says, for all the Republic's secularist pretensions, Catholicism remains part of France's national identity, and the murder of an elderly priest is just the kind of attack that could provoke sectarian tensions of the sort we are more used to seeing in the Middle East, as opposed to the heart of Europe. Sectarian tensions right into the heart of Europe. And for all of its secularism, as this article points out, Catholicism remains part of France's national identity, and it's the same with Germany. It's the same with all of Europe. This is that identity, that history, the roots, as I talked about yesterday, that Europe will soon return to, that some leaders are already calling for them to return to. Big changes are coming. Daniel 8:23. Read it again. We read it yesterday. Prepare yourself for the appearance of the King of Fierce Countenance. He's going to come in by flatteries, as chapter 11 brings out. Boy, you can sure see that the stage is being set for this. Well, what about the clash? I mean, the more and more you read, the more and more you see that this is building to a spectacular clash. Some commentators are beginning to see that. And isn't it amazing? Because that's exactly what Daniel 11 and verse 40 says will happen. The Wall Street Journal here about Europe's terror storm. It says Mr. Hollande has been sounding the war theme since November's terror attacks in Paris. And to that end, French planes have been dropping bombs on Islamic targets and so on. I mean, they've upped this and that. They've extended the state of emergency. All these things, the steps that they're taking to try to prevent these attacks. And it says here in the Wall Street Journal, all of this is helpful at the margin, yet France had a robust intelligence service long before the rise of Islamic State. The Normandy Church was mentioned on an Islamic State hit list discovered by authorities last year. And one of the attackers seems to have been on bail and under electronic surveillance for seeking to go to Syria. So they knew the church was on a hit list, and one of the terrorists was on a tracking device. But still, how do you stop a man from picking up a knife and just walking right into a church and killing an 84-year-old priest? All of this proves again that a war on terror can't be won merely with better police work or the intelligence surge proposed in the U.S. by Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Proper surveillance of a single suspect requires 20 or so agents. Just one suspect to properly surveil them. 20 agents? It says, which means France would need some 200,000 officers to monitor the people already on the government's terror list before November's attacks. The real number of French jihadists has surely grown since then. Notice this conclusion, though. This is right out of Daniel 11:40. And this is in the Wall Street Journal. It says here, the proper response to Islamic State is to go on swift and decisive offense. Swift and decisive offense. Interesting use of language there. Notice the terms. Swift and decisive offense. And think of that word whirlwind. In Daniel 11:40, it says, beginning with the eradication of its strongholds in Syria, Iraq, and Libya. It says, Mr. Olan may have declared war on Islamic State, but so far the fight has been more symbolic than strategic. Unless that changes, Tuesday's attack in Normandy will merely be one more of many horrors to come. You see, unless it changes the strategy, unless someone in Europe goes on the offensive, Hollande is, as the previous article brought out, he's very unpopular now. And we see the sentiment changing too in Germany, as I've said. And so, like I brought out yesterday, when the right leader comes along, the prophesied leader, the King of the North, is going to go on the offensive. As it says in Daniel 11, at the time of the end, it's for the latter days, this prophecy, the King of the South shall push at him. That's happening. That's happening. Look at this summer of hate, this summer of terror. Look at the timeline of terror. Look at the 5 or 6 attacks in just the last 2 weeks. And then back up to March and see the attack in Brussels. And then back up to November and see the attack, the massive attack in Paris. And other places in between, Orlando. The King of the South is pushing. And it says, the King of the North shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, ships. And he shall enter into the countries. Which countries? Those countries in the King of the South's region. And it mentions some of them by name even. Iran, of course, is the head of the snake. But then it mentions Egypt, it mentions Libya, it mentions Ethiopia. He shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. So the Bible says these two kings, the King of the South or Radical Islam, and the King of the North, the union of 10 states, 10 heads of state in Europe, there will be a clash of spectacular proportions in this end time, at the time of the end. That's what's coming. Catholic Europe clashing with radical Islam. History, in other words, repeating itself. Another Crusades. Israel, or the nations of Israel, the United States, Britain, they're not mentioned in this prophecy because they're too weak by that point to take any kind of meaningful action. But the one that is mentioned, isn't it interesting that the one that is mentioned, the King of the North, they're being hit now by the radical Islamic movement on an almost daily basis. You talk about an aggressive push. The Islamists, they want a holy war. They've already declared a holy war. They're already attacking churches right and left throughout the Middle East. And yesterday they waltzed into another one, this time in a quiet town in northern France, where they beheaded an 84-year-old priest. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Are we ready to make some history?
I move that Hillary Clinton be selected as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
Hillary knows that access and opportunity are the American promise.
Hillary Clinton isn't afraid to say that Black lives matter.
She knows that safeguarding freedom and security is not like hosting a TV reality show.
Hillary opened my eyes to a whole new world of public service by private citizens. This woman has never been satisfied with the status quo in anything. She always wants to move the ball forward. That is just who she is. And she is still the best darn change maker I have ever known. You could drop her into any trouble spot. Pick one. Come back in a month, and somehow, some way, she will have made it better. That is just who she is.
I can't believe we just put the biggest crack in that glass ceiling yet. If there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next. Thank you all. I can't wait to join you in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Some highlights there from last night's Democratic convention, put together by CNN, I believe. And so the media's love fest for the Democratic nominee. It will continue now through to November, for sure. The first night, though, we didn't have as much time yesterday to talk about it because, as I said at the end of yesterday's show, we just ran out of time. But that first day of the convention on Monday, that was dominated by Bernie Sanders and, of course, all of the turmoil in the Democratic Party and the chairwoman at the top having to step down because of, well, basically rigging the system to make sure that Hillary Clinton was the nominee to cheat Bernie Sanders out of a possible chance to be the front runner. In any event, Sanders came out and tried to bring some unity to the party, but as I said earlier, there was quite a lot of division, particularly on Monday. I think what's interesting, I mentioned this piece Monday, this Juan Williams piece in the Wall Street Journal, talking about how radical the Democratic Party is. Juan Williams says, history will record this week's convention as a coming of age for a new era of liberal Democratic politics. This is now Bernie Sanders' party. Other Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, are merely living in it. I mean, they've been pressured to go along with the extreme views, the extreme positions of this radical socialist communist ideologue. He's pictured on the cover of the Trumpet magazine, along with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi. That's just from January. And it's amazing. I went through that article more thoroughly yesterday. I had to kind of hurry on through it on Monday. But I went through it more thoroughly yesterday. And in fact, the whole issue, the personal from the editor in that issue, is where the Paris attacks are leading. This was in the January Trumpet. And then you have all of these features, two big features, on the thinking of Barack Obama, unriddling the radical worldview of the president, And then after that, of course, just the thinking of the Liberal Party, the Democrat Party, the roots of America's dangerous turn left, as my father put it. It's a dangerous turn. Let me read to you what it said in the New York Magazine. Yes, the New York Magazine from the other day. It says, ridiculous or not, they dominated the entire day. It was a testament to the power of a fanatical, disruptive minority. This is talking about the division on Monday. And, of course, the major media did everything that they could to try to cover it up and to make it seem like everybody was unified, that it was just a big love fest, that they were all in agreement, that Hillary's the one. It says here, in a sense, Sanders' entire campaign has been evidence of this same thing. And if the Bernie movement had convinced the mainstream of the Democratic Party of anything, it was how horrifying the world would look if that vanguard ever gained real power. Well, it's gained a lot of power because that whole party is just taking a dangerous turn to the left. And it's been going on now for years. And my father brings out in the piece on the Trumpet, or in the Trumpet magazine, just pointing out the similarities between the Democratic Party and communist ideology. You look through some of the stump speech points that Sanders rattled off in his speech on Monday. Here's just a sampling of that, clip number one.
This election is about a single mother, a single mom I saw in Nevada, who with tears in her eyes told me she was scared to death about the future because she and her daughter were not making it on the $10.45 an hour she was earning.
So minimum wage needs to be bumped up across the board. And you'll notice with all these clips, there's no real explanation on where this money comes from. We've added $10 trillion to the national debt in 7.5 years of President Obama's leadership. But you follow on the thinking of Sanders and to a large extent Hillary Clinton too. How much more can be added over the course of another 4 or 8 years? Here's what he had to say about the impact Hillary Clinton would have on the Supreme Court. Clip two.
Hillary Clinton will nominate justices to the Supreme Court who are prepared to overturn Citizens United. And end the movement toward oligarchy that we are seeing in this country. Her Supreme Court appointments will also defend a woman's right to choose. Workers' rights, the rights of the LGBT community, the needs of minorities and immigrants, and the government's ability to protect our environment.
She'll look after all of those things. He rattles off all of the Democrats' favorites, including this one here, about college tuition. Clip three.
This election is about the thousands of young people I have met all over this country. The thousands that I have met who left college deeply in debt, and tragically, the many others who cannot afford to go to college.
And so the solution, free tuition for everyone. He talks further about the changes that they need to make to prevent climate change. The greatest environmental crisis facing our planet, he said. And then also expanding, if you can imagine, expanding universal health care. It's not enough, Obamacare. It's not enough. We've got to go further. And we've read through an article last week just talking about how that this alone, Obamacare that is, the Affordable Care Act, how that this alone is breaking the financial back of America. So he brings up all of his most favored stump speech issues, raising the minimum wage, overturning Citizens United, free tuition, health care, climate change. And not a word about, well, how is this going to be financed? Now think again about the prophecy in Ezekiel 5, which foretells that one-third of our nations, one-third of our people will be destroyed by an economic and a social siege. And so many of our social problems, the breakdown in our cities, is going to come about because of this economic cataclysm. There's other factors too, like racial hatred and division. But it's going to turn into an all-out war with all sides fighting for survival, fighting for food and sustenance. That piece, by the way, last week, that Daniel Horowitz piece, talking about just the level, the incomprehensible levels of debt under the Obama administration, and how that we just continue to add it on, even though we're taking in, the federal government's taking in record levels of taxation. It says, this is Horowitz, Obama will exit the White House in about 6 months, but he will leave behind an indelible legacy of debt and economic stagnation that will mortgage the future of our posterity. It would be bad enough to leave a strong civil society with fiscal bankruptcy. However, when coupled with Obama's other legacy, exacerbating the decline of the moral fabric and family structure of this society, the moral bankruptcy will likely overtake us before the Chinese foreclose on our economy. This is what's coming, and yet you have leaders on the left, and the whole movement is now far left, that are talking as if, well, these trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that we've added to our debt, it's not enough. We've got to add twice that. We've got to add three times that. That was Bernie Sanders from Monday. Another speaker, Michelle Obama, she gave a speech on opening night that was praised throughout the mainstream media. Here's one snippet from the president's wife, Monday night, clip 12.
I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn. And because of Hillary Clinton, my daughters and all our sons and daughters now take for granted that a woman can be president of the United States. So look. So, don't let anyone ever tell you that this country isn't great. That somehow we need to make it great again, because this right now is the greatest country on earth.
An obvious swing there at Mr. Trump, whose slogan, Make America Great Again, one that he got from Ronald Reagan, is, well, this country is great, she says, but as a lot of commentators on the right have correctly noted, I mean, this statement comes from a woman who, in 2008, said that she was never proud of her country until finally her husband started to, well, look like he was going to be the president of the United States. This is Michelle Obama from 2008.
And let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult life, I am proud of my country because it feels like hope is finally making a comeback.
That was the first time that she was proud. Now, again, the statement the other night, in some ways she has to say that because, well, her husband's been president now for almost 8 years, and to come along like Trump is and say, you know, we've got to make America great again, that's saying that we've got to bounce back from all of this turmoil, from a stagnant economy, from being on the run internationally. We've got to come back. That's obviously a hit at the president. And so she comes out and says how great it all is now. But it wasn't great in 2008, in her view. And so much so that she hadn't been proud of her country ever as an adult. Not until 2008. And of course, when you think about what the president himself was saying leading into his election, the infamous statement about transforming the United States, this is clip 14.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Now go back, please, as I say, and read that January 2016 trumpet, the roots of America's dangerous turn left, where my father talks about how mainstream now so many of these beliefs of communism are in the Democratic Party, in our modern educational system. And the goal of this communist movement, which Herbert Armstrong was writing about back in the 50s and 60s, it's to destroy America's government. Read that article from January and see what my father has to say in there too about the attack on the police. That's what you had going on last night as well at the convention, with all of these mothers of these slain suspects. And the one leading the way, Mike Brown's mom. And by the way, no fathers mentioned. None of the fathers. We don't know where they are. But here the one leading the way was Mike Brown's mother, the black suspect who was going after the gun of that officer to kill him. And all that it does, putting all those mothers out as featured speakers at a Democratic convention, it just underscores the strategy of this dangerously left movement to attack the police, to attack authority, to bring down the government. This is what my father said in the article. This is all part of the left's plan to destroy the police. You can't take over a government and run it unless you get rid of the police, who are loyal to the system. So it's about bringing down the system. Well, going back to the comments that Michelle Obama made just the other night, this was how they responded to it on the Morning Joe show. This is Joe Scarborough. Well, there's a collection of people speaking, and Scarborough weighs in at the end. Clip 15.
I've seen a lot of great speeches at conventions. Mario Cuomo in 84, Ted Kennedy in 1980, yes. Barack Obama in 2004, Bill Clinton in 2012. I have never seen a speech, and given the presentation from a non-politician, really, the First Lady.
From the heart.
The presentation, but the content of the speech from the beginning about watching her children go off to school.
Chilling.
The speech was about our children. The speech was about us more than it was about politics.
It really was. And again, I got to draw my attention to Republicans right now who see me with clenched fists up in the air cheering Michelle Obama's speech to say, I don't know that Michelle Obama would appreciate that what I'm about to say, but her optimism and her hope reminded me of Ronald Reagan, who could talk about all of the problems that we were having and then look right at the audience, but always end by saying, I believe that America's greatest days truly do lie ahead.
Reminded Scarborough of Ronald Reagan, the speech that the First Lady gave on Monday night. Now, as I pointed out on Monday, when you compare, when you just compare some of the speeches, and there was a more hopeful, optimistic tone Monday night in that speech, but when you compare it even to her own speeches, and not just before 2008, her admission there that she'd never been proud of her country, but even many of the speeches, particularly the ones she's given on race at commencement exercises and such, in any event, whenever you hear it, it just makes me want to go back and look at what Reagan had to say, Reagan himself, and look at that time period in America's history. We've played twice already that clip from his party's nomination or his convention back in 1980, where he just added at the end of that speech those statements calling upon the entire convention to have a moment of silence, silent prayer. And he got choked up as he was saying it. He said he was afraid to suggest what he was about to suggest, but he was, well, more afraid not to do it, not to follow through, and really bow his head before God and seek God's help. Well, you fast forward a few months from that convention back in 1980. This is from Ronald Reagan's first inaugural address. He's voted into office. He became president late 1980, and so this would have been January 20th, 1981, his inaugural address, clip 8.
I'm told that tens of thousands of prayer meetings are being held on this day, and for that I'm deeply grateful. We are a nation under God, and I believe God intended for us to be free. It would be fitting and good, I think, if on each inaugural day in future years, it should be declared a day of prayer.
How about that? You put that together with how he concluded the convention just 6 months earlier. What a difference. What a difference from all of the politicians of today. Not to single one of them out even, but to just compare. Here he's saying, I mean, he didn't officially make it a policy, but he's saying, look, I think it would be fitting and good if we did this every inaugural day. If we had tens of thousands of prayer meetings across the country. Because we are, after all, a nation under God, are we not? We're a nation under God. It's there right in the Pledge of Allegiance. Here's another clip from that same speech, clip 9.
This is the first time in our history that this ceremony has been held, as you've been told, on this west front of the Capitol. Standing here, one faces a magnificent vista opening up on this city's special beauty and history. At the end of this open mall are those shrines to the giants on whose shoulders we stand. Directly in front of me, the monument to a monumental man, George Washington, father of our country. A man of humility who came to greatness reluctantly. He led America out of revolutionary victory into infant nationhood. Off to one side, the stately memorial to Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence flames with his eloquence. And then beyond the reflecting pool, the dignified columns of the Lincoln Memorial. Whoever would understand in his heart the meaning of America will find it in the life of Abraham Lincoln. Beyond those monuments to heroism is the Potomac River, and on the far shore, the sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David. They add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom.
You can see why he was called the great communicator. But it was more than just communication skills. Consider the content of that speech. A 15, 20-minute speech. Again, some 36 years ago. And all of that rich, illustrious history. The monumental man, George Washington. These great founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson. the Declaration of Independence, he said, flames with his eloquence. And if you're looking for meaning, the meaning of America, you find it in the life of Abraham Lincoln. And then, as Reagan so often did, he reminded Americans of the tremendous price, the tremendous price that's been paid for our freedom. This final clip here, if you listen closely, you can hear again where he gets pretty emotional talking about that price paid for freedom. This is clip 10.
Each one of those markers is a monument to the kind of hero I spoke of earlier. Their lives ended in places called Belleau Wood, the Argonne, Omaha Beach, Salerno, and halfway around the world on Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Porkchop Hill, the Chosin Reservoir, and in 100 rice paddies and jungles of a place called Vietnam. Under one such marker lies a young man, Martin Treptow, who left his job in a small town barber shop in 1917 to go to France with the famed Rainbow Division. There on the Western Front, he was killed trying to carry a message between battalions under heavy artillery fire. We're told that on his body was found a diary. On the flyleaf, under the heading My Pledge, he had written these words: America must win this war. Therefore, I will work, I will save, I will sacrifice, I will endure. I will fight cheerfully and do my utmost as if the issue of the whole struggle depended on me alone. The crisis we're facing today does not require of us the kind of sacrifice that Martin Treptow and so many thousands of others were called upon to make. It does require, however, our best effort and our willingness to believe in ourselves and to believe in our capacity to perform great deeds, to believe that together, with God's help, we can and will resolve the problems which now confront us. And after all, why shouldn't we believe that? We are Americans.
Why shouldn't we believe it? That we can do this, that we can solve these problems that we're facing with God's help. We each have a role to play, he said. We've got to be like that Martin Treptow, fighting on as if the issue of the whole struggle depended on me alone. It's hard to believe this was just 36 years ago. It is hard to believe how much the United States has changed in just a generation and a half. Look at the difference in leadership. You compare that speech with the talking points that you hear today, with the bickering and the fighting and just the self-centeredness and the corruption and the vanity and the arrogance and the godlessness of any leader today. My father says in that article, that danger is turned left. He keys in on that slogan, make America great again. Well, of course, we'd love to see that happen. Who wouldn't? But we've also got to confront our sins. My father wrote, America's problems are a direct result of America's sins. No political candidate today is going to make America great again, no matter what people think. I'd like to see it happen, but it isn't going to happen in this age. Everyone will come to recognize that truth before much longer. God will make America great again in the world tomorrow. He's going to solve our problems in spite of our rebellion. He will save America and the world. at Jesus Christ's return, which is what will happen immediately after these crises climax. It is coming. Greatness, prosperity, unity, love, commitment, dedication, and devotion. It is coming. Jesus Christ will bring it to this earth. And that, like that that listener who emailed in, that's something to really go out and shout about. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on yet another program. Email the show, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today. See you tomorrow.